We'd love to hear from him. Adam Kinzinger said he thinks the panel has proved Donald Trump broke the law in his attempts to overturn the election. Liz Cheney would not go so far. She said, I think that Donald Trump's violation of his oath of office, the violation of the Constitution that he engaged in, is the most serious misconduct of any president in the history of the United States. Liz Cheney added, the committee has not decided yet whether or not we'll make a criminal referral. I would also say that the Department of Justice certainly is very focused. Based on what we see publicly on what is the largest criminal investigation in American history. She noted, but there's no doubt in my mind that the former president of the United States is unfit for future office. Elaine Luria said, I sure as hell hope the Department of Justice has a criminal investigation at this point into Donald Trump. She also said Merrick Garland, the Attorney General, has already told us he's listening, and if he's watching today, I'd tell him he doesn't need to wait on us because I think he has plenty to keep moving forward. The House Committee has held 9 hearings, 8 in the summer run, which ended on Thursday, 21st of July, with almost 3 hours on Donald Trump's inaction while the Capitol was attacked. There will be more hearings in September. Liz Cheney said more interviews were scheduled and the committee anticipates talking to additional members of the president's cabinet. We anticipate talking to additional members of his campaign. Liz Cheney added, certainly we're very focused as well as on the Secret Service. The deletion of Secret Service text messages from 5th and 6th of January 2021, despite an order from the committee to preserve them, is another flashpoint. Liz Cheney praised witnesses including Cassidy Hutchinson, a former aide to Mark Meadows, and Sarah Matthews, a former White House press aide. Liz Cheney said, certainly, it is the case that the attacks against some of the women witnesses have been particularly vicious. I also think the response that we've seen from the House Republicans is really disgraceful. She added, I think our country is at a moment where we really have to all of us take a big step back and say, look, the normal, sort of vitriolic, toxic partisanship has got to stop, and we have to recognise what's at stake. And leadership of the Republicans and the House needs to be held accountable for their actions. Liz Cheney is expected to lose her seat in Wyoming over her opposition to Donald Trump. She would not be fully drawn on whether she plans to run for the Republican presidential nomination in 2024, when Donald Trump is expected to do so. Liz Cheney said, I've not made a decision about 2024, and I'm really very focused on the substance of what we have to do on the Select Committee. Very focused on the work and I have to do to represent the people of Wyoming, and I'll make a decision about 2024 down the road. She added, but I do think, as we look towards the next presidential election, I believe that our nation stands on the edge of an abyss. And I do believe that we all have to really think very seriously about the dangers that we face and the threats that we face, and we have to elect serious candidates. Israel above the law.
Sports in Palestine faces a lot of obstacles that disturb the true essence of what sport is about. Under Israeli occupation for more than half a century, the industry of sport suffers greatly, just as the Palestinians themselves suffer daily.
We participated in several championships, including the Batna International Championship in Algeria. We also participated in the Arabic Championship and took fifth place. However, Palestine was deprived from participating in many external championships due to the Israeli siege that has been imposed for the past decade. In those 10 years, time goes by, along with the age of players, which means the end of their sporting career.
The Israeli occupation does not like to see Palestinian sports that represent the Palestinians as a civilian nation to the world with the ability to compete with other teams. The Palestinian athletes do not have immunity at all. Palestinian sports in general is not immune, whether in times of war or without war. You may find the Israeli warplanes shelling a sports club or stadium, arresting a player, or preventing a team from participating abroad.
And now, the national anthem of Palestine.
Sports for Palestinians could perhaps play a role in international forums. But the Israeli occupation does not want any positive attention to shine on the occupied territory, and so it oppresses sports development as a strategy to keep the international community away from the occupation's repressive activities.
For your information, in some championships, Israel imposed on the host nation not to raise any country's flag so that Palestine's flag would not be raised. However, in the last championship held in Australia, Israel was not able to dictate its preferences. So Palestine's flag was raised and the Palestinian anthem was played when the Palestinian team marched out on the grounds. This is considered an achievement for us.
Having Palestine's flag raised in the Asian Championships for the first time was a huge achievement. However, raising our flag in Australia is our biggest achievement, especially as we know Australia voted against Palestine 2 weeks before at the UN Assembly. Our nation has the right to have a state and live in peace. We deserve to live. Today we are among 16 Asian countries. Although our country is under siege and the most basic necessities do not exist, our national team is here today, among the teams of great countries like Japan, Iran, Australia, Korea, and others. When hearing the national anthem here in this stadium with the players and technical team, in which I'm a member, with the rest of the Arab, Palestinian, and Asian audience, which supported our team to the finals, it gives you an indescribable feeling. This feeling comes because you're one of the soldiers who participated in raising the flag of your country in the international arena.
The Palestinian team qualified to the finals in the Asian Cup for the first time in history. The Asian Cup started in the 1960s. The Israeli occupation used to participate among other countries under the name of the State of Israel, as if Palestine did not exist. In 1970, a group of noble and honest Arabs expelled Israel from the Asian Football Confederation and replaced them with Palestine as a member. We regained our right to membership of the International Football Federation, in which we can participate in the World Cup. The occupation knows that sports creates a good image toward the Palestinian people, so it wants to sabotage it, destroy it, and hide it from the world. It wants to present the Palestinians to the world as terrorists.
For every athlete in Palestine, there is a sad tale of suppressed opportunity under the Israeli occupation, which deliberately puts obstacles before the Palestinian sporting industry to keep it behind closed doors.
One of the circumstances that helped me play football was living near Rafah Services Club and the UNRWA Club. I was able to get into the national junior team, the national youth team, then the Olympic team, and finally the national team. I received the best junior player title in the Palestinian League for the year 2005 to 2006. On July the 22nd, 2009, I was supposed to travel to the West Bank to join Balata Youth Center Club as a professional player at the boot camp of the national team in Al Farah. However, some other players and I were stopped, and I was arrested. I was the only one among them to be arrested, and without reason.
Made.
I was assigned to form the Palestinian Federation for Self-Defense Games, sponsored by the Paralympics Committee. This committee is specialized in training special needs athletes in order that they may participate in international championships and the Olympics. We received an invitation from the MRT Athlete Club to participate in the Dubai International Championship of 2016. We participated with a team of six players, one able female, an able male, and four visually impaired athletes. Our team competed strongly in this championship, and for the first time in Arab and Palestinian team, won third position and received a bronze medal. It feels great to raise the Palestinian flag and play the Palestine national anthem at such a championship. Upon our team's return back home, I was arrested by the Israeli police and detained for 5 hours, and the blind players were also held. My team insisted on not leaving without me. How could they leave when they have no one to guide them back home?
It's no coincidence that the arrest of Palestinian athletes has pushed a number of prisoners from the sports sector to more than 70. This number refers to the expansion of deliberate targeting of promising sports champions by the occupation.
I was detained without charge for no other reason than for being a Palestinian athlete representing my country. I spent 3 years in the Israeli prisons. During my sentence period, I was interrogated from time to time and manipulated to try to make me confess to anything. But in the end, they had to let me go. It shows to what extent the Israeli intelligence had nothing on me. They wanted to prove that they did not just arrest a Palestinian athlete, but a terrorist from their view. They could not prove anything, so they released me after 3 years. I was released, but with many health problems, because I had gone on a hunger strike for 96 days. These problems prevented me from continuing my football career. I do not wish for any athlete to experience the same situation I faced.
Upon our arrival to the Erez Beit Hanun checkpoint, we were supposed to have a press conference with a number of international journals and agencies. But to our surprise, I was arrested and the blind boys were held and pushed outside. I was held for 26 days in the interrogation cells at Ashkelon prison. They accused me of training terrorists. I responded, "If you say that these blind boys are terrorists, I wonder how you can call them terrorists." It was bizarre that the interrogator was watching some reports on YouTube about the team, and he knew that I was training these blind boys. They presented me with a number of trials, 5 trials consecutively. Each trial extended my arrest period. I was released after the last trial, innocent of all charges. I believe that the whole thing was for the purpose of disruption and killing of our happiness, so that the people in Gaza would not feel the joy of our success.
The case of Hassan al-Rai is not the first one. We have more than 70 to 80 cases like his. There is the case of Sami Ad-Daur, who was arrested simply for being a national team player, along with Fadi al-Sharif. Ayman al-Nafadi received a medical transfer to have a crucial ligament operation. After his operation, he returned back to Gaza and was immediately arrested with his fresh injury. Beit Hanun Eretz checkpoint has become a daily arrest and interrogation point. Its purpose is to insult people. How could a country that presents itself as being a democratic state grant an entrance visa to someone and then arrest them?
Israeli violations were not limited to false arrests. They adhered to discriminatory policies of not issuing travel permits for players to participate in both domestic and international championships.
Athletics games are competitive. It requires capabilities. To become international, you need tremendous capabilities. It requires the potentials of countries, not individuals. Because of the siege on our country and the closure of the Rafah border crossing for the past 2 years now, Palestinian runner Inas was not able to travel to participate in a championship in the UAE. She was was not given a pass to travel across Eretz Point. Furthermore, she was supposed to participate in the Beit Lehem 10-kilometer marathon, but she did not get a checkpoint pass for that either.
We exercised hard to have our names included in the Bethlehem Championship, but because of not receiving a checkpoint pass, I was deprived from participating. I trained intensely for the 10-kilometer race for 2 months prior to the race, even though I knew I had no permission to pass. We practiced hard, and I think maybe we could have won first place in that competition.
As a trainer for the national team, I suffered a lot moving between the governorates to reach Ramallah to be with the Palestine national team. It was hard for the players I chose from the clubs in Gaza to reach the northern governorates, which affected the competitive level of the national team. It is hugely suffering for the athletes inside Palestine.
We could not get the majority of our players to the northern governorates because of the delay in getting checkpoint passes. On one hand, because these games have specific dates, and on the other hand, the permissions to pass were either denied or given after the expiration of the specific date of the games. So Gazan athletes did not participate in these games.
Palestine participated in the 2010 World Cup playoffs. According to the draw, we were supposed to face the team of Malaysia. As we do not have a home ground, we used to play our games outside Palestine. We were matched up with Malaysia in an away game. We were supposed to meet the team in Malaysia, but 3 days before the match, the Israeli occupation prevented the Palestinian team from leaving. This injustice was not confined to the Israeli occupation. FIFA too was unjust towards us when it issued a statement in which the Palestinian team was condemned for not participating.
Practically every country in the world has a unified football league, with the exception of Palestine, which is forcibly deprived of that right. So the Palestinian Football Union seeks to at least unite the West Bank and Gaza Strip leagues to try to address Israeli measures that impose separation between the West Bank and the Gaza Strip.
The occupation is what divides the Palestinian territories into smaller parts. I'm referring to the 1948 Palestinian territories. There are the northern governorates of the West Bank and the southern governorates of the Gaza Strip. We try as much as possible to unite these communities by holding local competitions with the Palestinian clubs in the governorates of our land.
We have a diaspora league, the West Bank League, and the Gaza League. The teams in Gaza are not permitted to meet the teams of the West Bank, nor the diaspora. I mean, Barcelona and Real Madrid can move throughout Spain, but in Gaza, its teams play only each other, and the teams within the West Bank play each other. So there is one champion in Gaza and one champion in the West Bank. We've been appealing to the world to pressure the occupation to allow our teams access across checkpoints. This appeal is 20 years old now. We've had 20 years of league championships in Gaza, which have all been kept separate from the West Bank championships.
When the Palestinian National Authority took over, there were many attempts to have one unified league between the West Bank and Gaza. However, the obstacle of not having to pass the district prevented players from coming together. This also resulted in poor communications between the athletes and teams from each area. So we had to come up with the compromise of having two leagues. One league includes the clubs of Gaza, the other includes the clubs of the West Bank. I hope one day the winners of the two districts can play each other.
For a quarter of a century, we've appealed, and I myself appealed to football officials associated with FIFA, which is to have one unified Palestinian league. We want a league similar to that of the USA, Russia, Britain, Spain, France, Germany, and all countries around the world. We want to establish a unified league that unites the West Bank and Gaza, but Israel stands against this.
Setting a precedent, the Palestinian Football Union in 2015 held a match between trophy champions of the West Bank and Gaza, despite all that was done by the occupation to prevent any such meeting.
In 2015, the winners of the Cup of Gaza for the first time in 15 years met up with the winners of the West Bank Cup. They met despite the will of the occupation because of the intervention of FIFA. The away game was held in Gaza while the home game was held in the West Bank, and then we pronounced the outright winner.
The union decided to hold a match between the champions of the northern governorates and southern governorates so as to decide a unified champion that would represent Palestine in the Asian Games. The match was between the Shujaya Union Club, representing Gaza governorates, and Al Khalil Ahli Club, representing the West Bank. The Al Khalil Ahli Club won the championship.
We were excited, but Israel obstructed the event by arresting a number of players, and the Shabak Israeli Security Agency interrogated them for several hours. In addition to this, many players were refused a checkpoint pass. If it was not for the interference of FIFA and other countries, this sporting event would have not been held.
The escalation of violations by the occupying forces against Palestinian sports and athletes did not stop at international norms. Its momentum increased in the wars waged by the occupation on Gaza, the most violent of which occurred in the summer of 2014.
Palestine Stadium was shelled with a dozen bombs, each weighing about a ton. The stadium was completely destroyed. Not only the stands, but the whole field was unplayable. The Rafah Municipal Stadium was also shelled in 2008. This city has champion teams, but we've been unable to rebuild the stadium until now. Till now, I find it difficult as an athlete, a Palestinian, or even a follower of sports and current affairs to understand why the occupation would bombard playgrounds and sports clubs. We don't know the reason except to think that the occupation does not want to see any young Palestinian, especially athletes, to achieve greatness in sport or for them to play other Arab teams or internationally.
Rafah Stadium was one of the targets of Israel's military complex. We don't know why. It is just a stadium like any other around the world. Palestinian youth play in this stadium. It was, however, shelled with more than just one bomb by an F-16 warplane. The building and the grounds were completely destroyed. Now it is a playground without any stands. Of course, the field is not suitable to play on, but it is the only one that exists. Fragments of steel and rock can be still seen there. Many players stayed away from the stadium because of the bombardment.
Clubs were bombed, centers were bombed. More than 30 sports locations were bombed during the aggression on Gaza. There are no more than 5 stadiums, so the agenda of the General Federation of Football was affected dramatically. The capacity of other stadiums is limited, so by shelling these stadiums, from the Israeli perspective, it totally disrupts Palestinian sports.
The recent war on Gaza by the occupation's military exceeded every human standard and killed more than 27 Palestinian athletes. They joined the long list of victims who were athletes and martyred.
In the past 20 years, 400 or so Palestinian athletes have been martyred. These athletes are from all kinds of sporting backgrounds, football, volleyball, handball, and individual sports like martial arts. All of these sports lost memorable players. More than 400 Palestinian martyrs sacrificed their lives for the cause of Palestine. The Palestinian athlete is a Palestinian citizen before he or she is an athlete.
Israel deliberately targeted the sports sector as it did other sectors, such as health, social and economics. We in the sports sector have 400 martyrs. At the top is Captain Ahad Zakout, who is one of our trainers. Many young players also were assassinated in the southern governorates. We as sports people are supposed to have immunity under international law to travel and participate, but Israel flouts these laws and international regulations.
On the morning of July 30, 2014, one Israeli war jet targeted a residential apartment with a rocket. The apartment was owned by the late athlete Ahed Zakout in the Al Nasser neighborhood in Gaza City, bringing an end to the life of an athlete who continues to inspire many even after his death.
I woke up to the voice of my mother screaming my name and my father's name, Khaled and Ahad. I went out and answered, "Here I am." She asked me where my father was. I say, "I don't know. I will look for him." She ran out of the house screaming for someone to help. The living room was on fire. A missile had hit the house, smashing walls and room and setting the living room on fire. My uncle was the first to enter our house.
I turned around and came into the house. The bedroom door was broken, blocking the entrance. I kicked it with my leg and was surprised to see Ahed lying under the separating wall between the bedroom and the living room. He was still breathing. His son then entered and started screaming.
We told him to bear witness that there is no God, but Allah and Muhammad is his messenger. In his last moments, he was opening his mouth and closing it. Then the ambulance came and took him to the hospital, but he was later taken to the cemetery.
Captain Ahed Zakout was the star player of the Palestinian National Football League. He was the star of Gaza Sports Club and played in many clubs inside Palestine. Then he became a trainer after retiring as a football player. He focused on the youth. Captain Ahed Zakout wanted Palestine to have a promising future. He focused on having a national Palestinian team that would qualify for the finals of the World Cup in 10 years' time. But it seems this dream did not appeal to Israel. The Israeli occupation focuses on how to hit us at the core.
Despite all the crimes committed by the occupation against Palestinian sports and athletes, they would not be able to achieve their aims to undermine the resolve of the aspiring athletes who hope to represent Palestine at international tournaments and to hold high the Palestinian flag in states that have ignored and still ignore Palestinian rights. What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
in the limelight.
Former President Donald Trump and former Vice President Mike Pence held competing campaign events in Arizona on Friday, 22nd of July, as both publicly back rival Republican candidates for governor. The article you're about to hear has been written by Newsweek journalist Derek Roche. The article has been published by Newsweek and is titled Trump and Pence Stump for Rival Arizona Candidates. Former President Donald Trump and former Vice President Mike Pence held competing campaign events in Arizona on Friday, 22nd of July, as both publicly back rival Republican candidates for governor of Arizona. Thousands came to see Donald Trump at his rally in support of gubernatorial candidate Carrie Lake at Findlay Toyota Center in the state's Prescott Valley, where the former president took aim at President Joe Biden. Mike Pence's visit to Arizona appeared to be more modest, as a crowd of around 300 people reportedly attended an event in Peoria at a store that manufactures tactical equipment. The former Vice President Mike Pence spoke in support of the gubernatorial candidate Karen Taylor Robson. Both Republicans are considered likely to run for the GOP presidential nomination in 2024. While Donald Trump has strongly criticized Mike Pence for his refusal to support efforts to overturn the 2020 election. The former vice president also visited the National Border Patrol Council's office in Tucson, Arizona on Friday. The Border Patrol Union has strongly supported Donald Trump, but has endorsed Robson in the governor's race. Arizona Governor Doug Ducey joined Mike Pence and Robson at the events, and the former vice president criticized Carrie Lake for previously supporting Democratic candidates. When you get out and vote for Karen Taylor Robson, you can send a deafening message that will be heard all across America that the Republican Party is the party of the future, Mike Pence said. He added, Arizona Republicans don't need a governor that supported Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton. However, Mike Pence did not mention his break with former President Donald Trump or recent revelations from the House of Representatives Select Committee investigating the events of 6th of January 2021. Speaking at his Save America rally in Prescott Valley, Donald Trump criticized Doug Ducey as well as Joe Biden's handling of issues including inflation, and offered his full support for Lake's gubernatorial bid. Trump said Doug Ducey is all talk and no action, and you'll see what can happen when Carrie Lake becomes your governor. It'll be like day and night. He did not mention his former vice president in his remarks, but criticized Arizona State House Speaker Rusty Bowers, a Republican who testified before the House Select Committee about Donald Trump's attempts to pressure him into saying the 2020 presidential election was fraudulent. Donald Trump called Rusty Bowers a rhino, a coward who participated against the Republican Party and endorsed his Republican opponent in the GOP state Senate primary. The former president also warned that the United States could be heading for a recession, somewhat similar to the Great Depression that began in 1929. We've got to get this act in order. We have to get this country going, or we're going to have a serious problem, Trump added. Recent opinion polls suggest that Carrie Lake is the front-runner in the race in Arizona. The current Real Clear Politics average of recent Arizona surveys shows that the Trump-backed candidate leading her Mike Pence backed rival by about 8.5 percentage points. A survey carried out by OH Predictive Insights from 30th of June to 2nd of July showed Carrie Lake with a lead of 5 percentage points. The Trump-backed Republican had the support of 40% of likely GOP voters, compared to 35% who supported Karen Taylor Robson. An additional 21% were unsure, while the rest planned to back other GOP candidates who garnered single-digit support. The opinion poll included 515 likely voters and had a margin of error of plus or minus 4.3 percentage points. Trafalgar Group conducted an opinion poll from 14th to 16th of June that had Carrie Lake in the lead by double digits. The former television journalist was backed by 39% of likely Republican voters, and Karen Taylor Robson was supported by just 27%. More than 17% of respondents were undecided, and the rest supported other GOP contenders. The survey included 1,068 likely voters with a margin of error of plus or minus 2.9%. Arizona Governor Doug Ducey, who has faced substantial criticism from Donald Trump, slammed Carrie Lake in a recent interview on CNN. According to Doug Ducey, who cannot seek re-election due to term limits in his state, Lake's entire campaign is an act. He said the GOP candidate has been putting on a show for some time now, and we'll see if the voters of Arizona will buy it. Conversely, he described Karen Taylor Robson as the real conservative. She's the real deal. She started her career working for Ronald Reagan. She's pro-gun and pro-life.
Bazaar.
It is said nearly 70% of the world's protein comes from animal sources. While the plant-based trend is popular for the time being, meat is here to stay. Protein is also a brain food, vital for neurological and other bodily functions. Moreover, globally, the relationship between humans and livestock is fascinating. It has transcended time and space. Yet despite all the world's technological and scientific accomplishments, mankind has failed to replicate livestock's exact contributions to food, clothing, and even energy.
Hello there, and welcome to the second segment in our two-part edition of Bazaar. Last week, we discussed the knowledge-based production of potatoes in agriculture and how technology has helped expand this sector. This week, the program focuses on livestock rearing and all that goes into producing high-quality meat and dairy. Yum, yum. So stay with us as we check out their economic and national food security contributions.
Last time, we visited Khazai Agricultural and Livestock Breeding Complex and explored their agricultural and cultivation units. This time, we will look at their advanced animal husbandry divisions and what led them to livestock rearing. To begin with, it all starts from the soil. Over time, the ground needs constant enrichment for high-yield harvests. After this company shifted to knowledge-based potato cultivation, it realized the best way to prepare the farmlands for the next round of planting was to employ the help of sheep. This company has around 2,400 hectares of farmland, and fertilizing this much land becomes a mammoth task. So, it decided to bring in the heavyweights of the fertilizing sector and started its cattle breeding unit. And as a result, it also launched its animal feed production facility, where they scientifically formulate feed and test ingredients for the best quality. As the cows are allowed to roam the lands periodically and are fed high-quality food, the dairy and meat they produce are also very nutritious. They have thousands of Holstein cattle at their rearing unit, and the milk produced is rigorously tested.
Typically, livestock is fitted with digital tags. This is the animal's profile, which can be modified or added according to the animal's examination. They also serve as an identity card so caretakers can keep track of each animal's health and other features. This is also important information for veterinarians and the animal's products, which are further examined in advanced labs.
Each animal born or brought to the facility is given a digital tag after a lab examination. This company's advanced veterinary and genetic lab complex carries out essential functions. It's worth mentioning that one of its labs is mainly dedicated to testing cows and their milk. Here, milk is tested for its microbial load. This usually involves a standard plate count, which determines the total number of bacteria in a sample. These results are then used to determine the grade of milk. It might be interesting to know that this company has received numerous awards for being the best model cattle breeder in the province and the country. These titles were granted based on meeting nearly 40 standards of the Ministry of Agriculture. Such achievements were made possible by dozens of expert staff employed at this company. Its other laboratory is dedicated to raising sheep. At this facility, sheep are genetically selected for specific characteristics. They are also genetically bred to produce twins and sometimes triplets. This company has never stopped eyeing the future. It plans to expand its facilities further while incorporating new technology and applying the latest science to increase the quality of its products.
In 2019 was considered the golden period for red meat production in the country. Since then, production has grown each year, primarily because of the removal of an export ban. 3 years ago, Iran imported large amounts of meat to supply domestic needs, while domestic meat production was operating at full capacity. The ban was implemented to stabilize the market and support local production.
Iran's Livestock Exporters National Assembly estimates domestic needs for red meat at around 60 million heads of light livestock annually. Last year, this number was 72 million, which is well above average. This meant 12 million light livestock were ready for culling and exports. The Ministry of Agriculture puts red meat's domestic per capita consumption at over 12 kilograms, with lamb being the most popular red meat. This year, the National Statistical Center, or SCI, reported red meat production stood at nearly 51,000 tons in the month of May alone. Based on the SCI figures, over 1.3 million livestock holding farms are spread across the country. 54% of these farm small livestock and 26% are dedicated to large livestock husbandry. The remaining 20% farms both large and small livestock. The meat industry in Iran is worth some $2 billion. But not all livestock are raised for meat.
They are also reared for their milk. Based on the SCI, Iran annually produces nearly 9 million tons of raw milk. 70% of this amount is produced on industrial farms, and the rest comes from traditional dairy farms. Going off of figures from Iran's Customs Administration, on average, roughly 800,000 tons of raw milk are exported annually, valued at around $800 million. All things considered, Iran's livestock industry is booming and is an excellent place for investors who will see quick returns and profit. Khorasan Razavi province specializes in livestock rearing and potato cultivation. Khozai is a family business handed down to four generations over the years. It has some 2,400 hectares of farmland where saffron, Mohammadi roses, potatoes and wheat are cultivated. This company has spent years perfecting a cultivation system using its own agrotechi, enabling it to enhance the performance of mini-tubers. So what is a mini-tuber? They are the first generation of nuclear miniature seed potatoes. These can be engineered to have disease-free characteristics and are bred to shorten field cycles, leading to high harvest yields of healthy potatoes. The beating heart of this company is its research and development department. This is where production actually begins. This company has several varieties of potatoes in in vitro tissue culture form that are subject to rigorous disease testing. This ensures the company starts cultivation with the highest quality tissue cultures. After lab tests, the plant material is transferred to hydroponic greenhouses and later taken to the field for mass production.
You might be wondering why some farmers choose hydroponic methods over others. It's a soilless system where roots are kept in a dark environment saturated with an aerosol of nutrient-rich solution. This way, cultivators can observe the entire plant structure and strictly control production phases. Plus, this high-tech method gives cultivators unique insight into specific plant characteristics that can assist with field production.
As we mentioned earlier, this company also specializes in raising sheep and cows for meat and dairy production. It's interesting to know how potato production led to livestock rearing. The founder and director of the company shares his experience with us. After the mini tubes are raised in greenhouses, a portion of them is stored in refrigerated rooms for later use. Other storage facilities hold potato seeds and harvested products, which are later released into the market. It is no surprise that this company has received three consecutive national awards for being a top producer of livestock and agricultural products. Much of its success is attributed to a large amount of science and knowledge used for production. This company employs expert staff and researchers who also play a significant role in the company's dynamic progress. As part of its future vision, this company is eyeing expansion. It is already working on launching a botany clinic and other food-related laboratories. This company takes a great deal of pride in its socially responsible productions. It has spent decades trying to optimize its use of natural resources and make organic and nutritious products.
The company we just mentioned is just one example of how the agricultural industry is expanding with the help of modern technology. Iran produces tons of agricultural products annually, which it also exports to destinations abroad. The food industry is also heavily dependent on this sector as it plays a critical role in the country's food security and national economy.
Iran has a total area of 165 million hectares of land. Of this amount, 50 million hectares are arable farmlands. Moreover, some 21,000 hectares are dedicated to greenhouse farming. Iran's agriculture makes up around 8% of the national GDP. Plus, it employs one-fifth of the country's entire workforce. The country's agro-food products also accounted for around 20% of the country's non-oil exports in 2020. Data from Iran's Customs Administration shows that Iran exported over $800 million worth of agricultural products from April through May this year. Additionally, figures showed over 1.7 million tons of these products were sold to foreign markets during that period. Around half of the revenue generated from exports belonged to 10 major agricultural products. Championing the top of the export list were pistachios. This was followed by watermelon and tomatoes in terms of export value. Horticulture, aquaculture, and livestock products also raked in millions in foreign exchange. Industry analysts say there has been a relative decline in exports compared to the same two-month period last year. They say more attention should be given to marketing, better packaging, and transportation to boost agricultural exports. The Chamber of Commerce, Industries, Mines, and Agriculture also released a report examining the relative decline in agricultural products. The report showed a less than average rainfall coupled with misuse of natural resources in farming practices are two of the major culprits of reduced production. Mining is the process of extracting valuable materials from the Earth's crust. It is one of the oldest industries and dates back to prehistoric times when people first mined flint to make tools and weapons. However, mining has come a long way from its traditional methods to incorporate advanced material science and geology. Moreover, modern mining wouldn't be the same without its heavy-duty machines to extract and haul material for processing. On the whole, this sector is one of the largest and most productive industries the world has ever known.
We are going to take a look at Iran's mining industry while shining the spotlight on zinc dust production. We wanted to see how this stuff is made and where it's used. Plus, we will explore this sector's contributions to the national economy.
To better understand the most recent developments in the mining industry, we visited Zarin Rui Caspian. It is a subsidiary of the parent company Zarin Industrial Mining Group and specializes in making zinc dust. Products at this company come in the form of bluish-gray zinc powder or granules. These products are made with specific formulations depending on their end use. In short, these items are produced when purified zinc vapors are condensed. But this requires a large amount of processing, starting with melting zinc crucibles. Next, the molten zinc is transferred to a vaporizing furnace. The vapors are then sent to a condenser to form zinc dust by circulating the gas through a cyclone cooler. Most zinc dust production plants include a vertical crucible melting and vaporizing furnace and a condenser, which operate on a fluid and continuous basis. That's why this production company works around the clock without breaks. Now you might be wondering where zinc powder is used. Due to its unique characteristics, it is a sacrificing element that helps prevent corrosion. Meaning it works well in absorbing moisture and strengthening metal surfaces against oxidation. It is a perfect substance for coating industrial machines that withstand harsh climatic conditions.
So many processes are at work when it comes to mining. There is exploration, extraction, and refining of raw material, just to name a few. But activities don't end there. Usually, there are mega holding companies in the mining sector with several subsidiaries, such as the company we just mentioned. These subsidiaries are essential in expanding and completing mining-based products' supply chains.
An asset to corporations is their research and development departments. This is because they carry out activities leading to technological development. That is to say, they develop new services or products and improve existing ones while elevating the company's industrial standing. This department also performs critical quality control checks where standards are also implemented. And indeed, standards are everything, especially for foreign trade. One of this company's competitive advantages is its high purity products based on national and international needs. This company also purchases most of its raw materials from domestic suppliers. Among its services, it can formulate zinc powders based on special orders from customers. It also provides its customers flexible delivery, whether by sea, air, or ground. This producer has never stopped looking to the future. It plans to increase its current market share and create new products that can be used in other down-the-line industries. This company has achieved many successes despite being relatively recently established. But that's not to say it has not faced many challenges along the way. One such challenge has been maintaining its machines, which sometimes require spare parts for repairs.
Well, I'm going to go into a several-minute silence because my good friend and colleague is out there on the field to give you guys a wonderful report. Take it away.
In a world grappling with coronavirus, a significant number of health-related companies have been looking for a solution to contain the spread of the virus. With the development of various testing methods, there has been a huge spike in demand for the virus sampling kits, and especially the sampling swabs.
God, I'm just so very tired of wearing masks. But what can I say? Ever since the pandemic took the world by storm, our life has changed in an unpredictable way. One of the prominent changes is the development of sampling technology to meet the evolving need of COVID-19 testing. Today, we came to Damahi Biotechnology Company to see how the sampling swabs that we see everywhere are produced. So don't go anywhere. Stay with me.
At the start of the outbreak, most of the sampling swabs were imported into the country and the domestic supply chain had been inconsistent. For this reason, this Iranian company in biotechnology decided to take steps towards promoting local sampling swabs on a large scale. When it comes to production, the swabs are produced in two different forms: oral swabs and nasal swabs. Anyway, let's take a look at the production line.
All right, the production process of the sampling swabs begins in this unit. At this stage, after the plastic handles are imported into this factory, they go through the swab flocking machine to form the header. Actually, when I look at it, it kind of looks like the ear cleaning swabs that we use on a day-to-day basis. But in fact, they are completely different. These headers are actually made of fibers, so it's totally something else. When the swabs are produced, they get to this stage for quality control and cleaning before they get to the packing hall. And finally, they pass through the sealer machine for pressing. But I should mention that the swabs are not finalized at this stage. They have to go through the sterilization process, and by the end of the day, the sterilized swabs are transported to different laboratories all across the country.
In case you wonder about the head of the swab, unlike how we thought earlier that it looks like the ear-cleaning swab, the foam-headed material eliminates the possibility of adhesive residue contamination. So by the end, the sterilized sampling swabs are distributed for field or home testing to meet the growing need of the country.
though it looks very similar.